This is Jim Inkster coming today. We'll visit with Mashir Robinson, the Economic Development Director for the Louisiana NAACP. Mashir Robinson has some thoughts about race in America in the aftermath of the tragedy in Ferguson, Missouri, and the latest development involving a Baton Rouge police officer accused of racist text resigning and possibly facing criminal charges. Also, we'll visit with Dan Bornay, the voice of the Valley since 1986, the man at the PA system, whose voice will permeate the rafters of Tiger Stadium, capacity 102,321, the ninth largest arena in the world, as LSU opens against Sam Houston State in its home opener Saturday night. And Steve Almond, his book, talk about taking on a sacred cow, Against Football, One Man's Reluctant Manifesto. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Our leadoff guest is Mashir Robinson. He's the Economic Development Director for the Louisiana NAACP and also an advisor to the White House. Mashir is a graduate of Brown University, like Governor Bobby Jindal, and a Rhodes Scholar, like Governor Bobby Jindal. And his politics are much different than those of Governor Bobby Jindal. Good morning, Mashir Robinson.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well, and I understand you're in the shadow of the White House as we speak.
Yeah, our building is actually right across the street from the White House, so our joke is in my office, I can actually look at the snipers.
So what's going on?
We have to be well-behaved here.
I hear when the light's on, that means the president's home.
Well, I can't. Unfortunately, he's on the other side of the house, so I can't see.
Okay. Well, there's a statue of a president outside the White House, in the park across the street, and some people who've been to the White House many times probably don't appreciate who that president is. Do you know who that is, Mashir Robinson?
No, who is the president?
Andrew Jackson. It is essentially
That's the Jackson little square. That's silly of me not to remember that.
It's reminiscent of New Orleans. But
yeah, it is.
Speaking of, we're going to talk about what's happening in Louisiana and what's happening nationally and the lessons learned from another tragedy of racial texture in Ferguson, Missouri. Nicholas Kristof, in a column in the New York Times last week, says, many white Americans say they're fed up with the coverage of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. A plurality of whites in a recent Pew survey said that the issue of race is getting more attention than it deserves. Bill O'Reilly of Fox News reflected that weariness, saying all you hear is grievance, 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 money, money, money. But Nicholas Kristof says we need to have more attention, not less, on race in America. Your thoughts?
Well, first off, I'm very familiar. My sister-in-law actually lives in Ferguson. She has her pediatric practice there. And so I know it very, very well. And I think that this is not particularly just a Ferguson problem, but in that part of the world, in Missouri, it is very much like Louisiana, carries with it a shadow of racial contradictions, which are deep and long. And hence, the Missouri Compromise, all that other sort of thing. And I think the opposite's the case about the need for attention. I applaud a Republican for actually taking this on, as has Rand Paul, suggesting that we need to get much deeper beyond just where the president, having a black president or a black attorney general, and really embrace the level of economic underdevelopment, people with criminal records, performance gaps in education, all of which have deep historic roots. So my final comment on this is, if we can say that Israel should exist and Jewish people should have the right of return to a place because of 2,000 years of long ago history, we certainly can look at history that is immediate, and its legacy is just generate a few years ago in terms of de jure segregation and slavery. So I think we can't have it both ways, where we talk about the contradictions of other people in other parts of the world, but we're unwilling to examine our own contradictions.
Closer to home, here in Baton Rouge, story in The Advocate today, officer accused of racist texts resigns, criminal charges still possible. A Baton Rouge police officer accused of sending racist text messages resigned yesterday. NAACP leaders say they want answers. Michael Ellsbury has been with the department for 15 years, faces a possible criminal investigation, according to the Baton Rouge Police Department. The allegation surfaced when your friend and associate, NAACP State President Ernest Johnson, said he was shown a series of text messages with racial slurs that purportedly had been sent by Ellsbury to a friend outside of the police department. Carl Abity, the chief, says they were given to police by a girl, a friend. That's a quote in the story. Part of the string of texts reads, "I wish someone would pull a Ferguson on them and take them out. I hate looking at those African monkeys at work. I enjoy arresting those thugs with their saggy pants." Your response, Mashir?
Well, you know my story with my own black sons and in having them stopped and thrown in police cars because we're not supposed to live in the neighborhood. So this is a real problem. I mean, it's sort of whether walking while black, driving while black, being black, this sort of mentality that is just so pervasive amongst law enforcement that has contempt for black life. And it's not as simple as having more black police officers, because many of those officers, to become accepted, either buy in or turn their eyes away to protect themselves. So it's very complex, this situation, and it is not one officer. It is a pervasive reality. And the Justice Department study that will now go on in Ferguson could be modeled across any police department, as we did in New Orleans they're almost in receivership, and we've forced out the police chief in New Orleans, and which is brought in and promoted an African-American lieutenant to become the chief, with the whole idea of repositioning the mentality of the police force, not just the way in which they're positioned in the French Quarter. It's much deeper than that. And it's a problem we have all over the country. Lee Brown, the former mayor of Houston, who had been the police chief in Los Angeles, Houston, and New York, I mean, Lee is... does heroic work in trying to get police departments like the one in Baton Rouge to come to grips with its reality. It's not as simple as having a black mayor. The police are an island unto themselves, and unless you have a community-based review board that's totally independent, there really isn't a way to govern that part of our government activities. I mean, they're out there, and every once in a while we get a glimpse into the mentality, but it's not often enough. And for many Anglo people, they see the police as their defenders against the black hordes. It's a deep contradiction we have in this country, and we're going to have to come to grips with it.
All right. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for Mashir Robinson. Now lives in New Orleans, by the way, and spends much time in Washington. He is a stone's throw from the White House as we speak, and he is an advisor to the White House, and we'll get to what he does with this administration. But if you'd like to talk about this topic, and race in America is a very large topic, whatever your opinion, we invite your participation. Charles on North Foster, good morning, Charles. You're on with Mashir.
Good morning, Jimmy. Good morning to you, guests. Jim, you mentioned there was a statue of Andrew Jackson in Washington. There's also a Confederate officer. Albert Pike has a statue of Washington, which I can't understand. But my question is this. Reverend Louis Farrakhan said with the election of the president that he was happy, but he was very concerned about the backlash for young black men in America from people who were going to be angry at the election of this president. When I look at Ferguson, when I look at what happened here with the Baton Rouge police officer, and one more thing, we had a prosecutor doing the Trayvon Martin case who used the N-word to refer to young African-Americans like Trayvon Martin. I don't think anything happened to him. What do you think is that connection real, and why hasn't the Justice Department followed up on a consent decree?
All right. Your response, Mushir Robinson.
Well, it's a very interesting point about the consent decree. I think a lot of the issues related to the Justice Department are budgetary. They have limited bandwidth. Remember, the expanse of their responsibilities are everywhere, in literally every corner of economic part of our society. The work they're doing around the banks and the financial collapse, and I mean, we can go on and on and on. And that's a real, and race is just unfortunately one of the contradictions that they have to face, and they alone are not able to get it done. The only thing they can do essentially is pace set an examination, but in a body politic that is a hardened heart against race, which you've just pointed out, the momentum is limited, and the frustration of African Americans continues to escalate, which we see in the breaking points in Brooklyn and Staten Island, Ferguson, Missouri, etc.
In the column I cited from Nicholas Kristof, he writes, the net worth of the average black household in the United States, that's net worth, $6,314. That's the average, compared to an average for white households of $110,500. That's according to the census. The gap has worsened in the last decade. The U.S. now has a greater wealth gap by race than South Africa did during apartheid. Whites in America, on the average, own 18 times as much as blacks. In South Africa in 1970, the ratio was 15 times. And the black-white income gap is roughly 40% greater today than it was in 1967.
Yes.
So despite the progress, we've got issues, and it's the old axiom of follow the money. Right now, there are people, white and black, who are having difficulty making it in this community, but more often than not, on a percentage basis, black households are suffering far more dramatically than whites.
And we've always had this position that if people could just get a college degree, everything would be okay. Well, obviously that isn't the case. So we have a structural problem that goes back many years. On the other hand, in terms of any transformational strategy, the black community itself cannot be a laid-back victim. It has to take certain strategic steps collectively, not in the context of everybody living in a, quote, in a black belt that's segregated and creating some kind of special black economy. Probably the opposite's the case, that we need to be part of the greater society because the housing conditions and public health and sanitation conditions in the black communities and these old decaying communities where people live doesn't make that very tenable. Public housing, all this other stuff. So the black community has to be more than just a place. It has to be a state of mind and commitment to working with one another and with other groups to create some form of transformation, some new forms of partnership. And there are people, even in the Republican Party, who have a mentality to try to make that happen. Now, I'm not clear that that's necessarily where our governor's mind share is, but there are people who I think, I give you an example. I know this is probably very odd. If I actually call Senator Vitter and ask him for something, he will do it, even if it's against his interest, but there's a relationship and there's some trust, and he'll go. I mean, so we have funny things that do happen.
You say Senator Vitter will answer your call and try to help you if you call him.
Yes.
True of Senator Landrieu?
Yes. Senator Landrieu, obviously. But my point here is that we can't tell who's going to be an ally.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. Michelle Southern producing, and our guest for a bit longer is Mashir Robinson, the Economic Development Director for the Louisiana NAACP, and I also identified him as an advisor to the White House. What exactly are you doing with the administration, Mashir?
One of the things that the president has done, which has not been covered very well, is he's created something called the Africa Power Initiative. We, as everybody's been overshadowed by this Ebola thing, well, in the continent of Africa, whose economy and whose size of population and workforce will rival China's by 2050, only 20% of the continent's people have power. So this is a $1 trillion economic opportunity for American businesses to become involved in building the power sector, both generation, distribution, transmission, all sides of the power equation. And so 3 weeks ago now, we had 51 African presidents, their finance ministers, their energy ministers, and various high-level other people here in Washington visiting with American businesses. We had a large part of the Congress stayed over from their break to participate in this activity. So what I'm doing is basically trying to help people understand, because of my investment banking and strategy consulting background, how these things can be financed, how American business can participate, how we can leverage things like the Ex-Im Bank, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, World Bank funds, other things. So that's what I'm doing, and I'm involved in developing personally with another partner a couple of power plants in Africa myself.
Very good.
So that's what I'm up to.
Okay. Yeah, I'm citing another statistic in the Kristof story from the New York Times of August 30. He says, a study from the Public Religion Research Institute suggests that in a network of 100 friends, a white person on average has one black friend. That's average. So obviously most white people have no black friends.
What you see, you know, Jim, when you go to a wedding, when you see a wedding party or something, I constantly see this and I'm scratching my head. How come there are no black friends at the wedding? But the opposite, that it's often, typically African-American people have some Anglo friends. And so you will typically see a few, but clearly we don't have enough close social relationships of trust where we're able to break bread, where we go to each other's homes, where we vacation together, where we have those kinds of very close relationships. And this is one of the only ways we're going to build trust and create transformation if we participate. And so one of the most important things is if companies in Louisiana would start appointing African-Americans to their boards and start getting people integrated. Because if the business community is the leadership in Louisiana and in America, business has to begin taking a leadership position. There are plenty of available and qualified people. But when you look at the bank boards, the industry boards, et cetera, there are no African-Americans in any of these Louisiana companies and no senior African-American officers running anything in Louisiana.
Well, in this community in which I live, and you once did, most neighborhoods are segregated. You experienced that personally, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I mean, I went when we first came here. As you know, we tried to buy a home in a gated community, and when they found out I was African American, the block bought the house. and then of course we lived on Highlandia, off Highland Road by LSU. We had a situation where my sons a couple of times got picked up by police cars because neighbors, not knowing we lived on the block, thought these were black invaders. And the rap was, well, there had been break-ins in the neighborhood. We had private security at the front of the block. Nobody was getting broken in. But it was just that kind of mentality that you're always the other. And it's pretty deep.
Charlotte in Iberia Parish. Charlotte, you're on with Mashir Robinson.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mashir. I'm calling to ask because I had seen a feature on the news where African mothers who were pregnant had to walk long distances to get health care. Is there any program in the weeds that can provide bicycles for them? And it would be easier, in my opinion, for them to get to their destination. I know that vehicles would be impossible because there are no gas stations, but what about bicycles? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
By the way, that is an enormously positive suggestion. In certain areas where there are in fact roads, even if the roads are in bad condition, broken up from lorries, the opportunity to ride bikes or to have a bike would be helpful, but very difficult for a pregnant woman, as an example, to ride a bike 20 kilometers to a clinic. So, but for other purposes, it would be helpful if we could get more bicycles there. And it might be a suggestion that we need to make in terms of our USAID type of grants or Chinese grants or whatever to increase the bicycle population, because clearly China biked its economy forward. And we could use a lot more bicycles in Africa. It's actually a brilliant idea.
I have an email from a listener, and I'll try to paraphrase a very long email about the Scott Rogers saga. I'm not sure you're familiar with this. A television host here in Baton Rouge from Britain who came to this country, became very popular in this community, was a chaplain and a sheriff's deputy with the East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Department, and was a minister and highly lauded for his work. And he had been tried in Great Britain on charges of sex abuse, acquitted on one charge. The jury hung on five others, and last week the man was killed in a murder and attempted suicide by his lover, who also was his son-in-law. Now, the listener, who says she is African-American, says that black people in this city and in this country have trouble getting a loan and have extensive background checks, and yet somebody who comes to this country, at the time not as an American citizen, is hiding in public view with a sinister past, and her implication is that Mr. Rogers got a pass that would not go to somebody of color. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's probably the case. However, I will say the following, that because it does draw another issue, which is gay folks and situations. I'm not dealing with them as in quote, some kind of pervert or something, but one of the painful things I've witnessed in my life is the need for people who have different kinds of sexual persuasions to have to be underground even from their families. So there is a deep contradiction there, and that community also suffers contradictions in terms of what they can and cannot do. In terms of this specific case of this person and this tragic life that he led, clearly an African-American of upstanding virtue might not be able to get a loan, because we use Fair Isaac, and somebody of the utility reported that they didn't pay their bill on time, but it was really the utility's fault, and their credit score is knocked down, and nobody judges their character, and they can't get a mortgage. So, I mean, they're right. There is a lot of that kind of stuff that goes on in the way in which people experience credit, experience background checks, all kinds of, nobody will forgive you for having been arrested at 17 for smoking a joint. It's bad.
Here's a quote from Reverend Jesse Jackson. He says, and this was a quote of about 20 years ago, but it's in the Christoph column, "There's nothing more painful to me than to walk down the street and hear footsteps and start thinking about robbery and then look around and see somebody white and feel relieved." Is there some truth to what Reverend Jackson said?
I think there is that kind of scarring that exists on people, black and white, in America, where if you, I mean, even today, when you look at television is a segregated experience. and most of the characters we see on television are in fact in movies, and they play various different perverted roles. All of this is built into the mentality, the gangster type view of who we are as people, as African American men. And yeah, I think that people have that sense of fear. And for whatever reason, I walk anywhere in the world and I never feel afraid. Maybe that's my spiritual side or whatever, but I do concur with Reverend Jackson that that's a possibility that many people feel.
Getting back to what Charles on North Foster said when he called in, I think on the whole, the election of an African-American president has been a very good thing for this country, but there are some byproducts of this that are not so pleasant. It's always a mixed bag. You have the good and the bad, but there are those who thought that by virtue of President Obama winning the election in 2008, that this was a panacea for all the racial ills that we've had in this country for centuries. Obviously, that was not the case.
No. It's also funny, another side in the commentary, is that if President Obama were a firebrand, he never would have been elected. But now, because he's this cool customer, so to speak, he's criticized for not showing enough emotion and passion, whether it has to do with the beheading of this sainted American journalist, or it has to do with Ferguson, whatever it is. He has kept a very calm and reasoned approach. He's clearly one of the most cerebral presidents, probably since Wilson. And because he's an African-American, people are using this cerebralness to say that he's detached, he's a vacillator, he's this, that, and the other, when in fact, because of his very nature as a black man, if he were other, he wouldn't even be in the position. It's a very, very deep commentary in America in terms of what an African-American person needs to be to be allowed to cross over, be acceptable to the greater audience, but also simultaneously be relevant to the black community.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems we're making progress, but baby steps, if you will. There was a time when a police officer in any community in this land could make a statement, as the one in Baton Rouge is alleged to have made, and get away with it. This man has lost his job and probably his reputation, might have to move elsewhere. That is something that would not have been the case in 1965, but it is today. How far have we come, and how far do we need to go?
Yeah, well, clearly we've made some significant gains for what I would say for the few. We've also made some gains in terms of, let's say, structural by law, walls come down so we can do certain things for everyone. But as you talked about the structural divide in America economically and in terms socially, that those walls are still pretty ironclad. We have a long way to go on this, and we have to, our churches, our businesses have to become much more aggressive in addressing the need for a whole America versus a balkanized America. And this current immigration situation is flaring those kinds of negative divisions even more than they've ever been.
Mushir, it's always good to talk with you, and hope we do so again soon.
Thank you, brother, and God bless to you and your audience.
Thank you. Good morning. And now we're joined by one Dan Bornay, the voice of the Valley since 1986, and he'll start his 29th season as the public address announcer, the voice we hear in Tiger Stadium tomorrow night as LSU hosts mighty Sam Houston State. Good morning, Dan Bornay.
Sam Houston State is the alma mater of Dan Rather.
That is correct. They named the journalism school after him.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the other thing up there at Huntsville is a prison and a Holiday Inn where the LSU team used to stay when it played Texas A&M at College Station in the old days. It'd stay at that Holiday Inn in Huntsville and bus in to College Station for the game. So remember that well back in the 80s.
Well, tomorrow night the game's at Tiger Stadium. And as noted, this will be your 29th year as the PA announcer. And to put this in perspective, most of us revere 1958, the year of my birth. And to think that when you took the mic at Tiger Stadium, Dan, we were 28 years removed from 1958. And now we're 28 years removed from 1986 when you began your odyssey as the voice of the Valley. That's a sobering reality, isn't it?
Well, it's sobering that you're as old as you are and you're still, able to do what you do.
And you got the job in the most unusual way. There were no other applicants.
That's exactly right. Sid Crocker retired, and you knew Sid, Jim. Everybody knew him. And he retired after, I guess, you've actually researched this, 31 or 2 years. I forgot how many years Sid actually did the PA, but it was 30 or more. And I called him when he retired, and I had known him many years back because we had worked together at Channel 9. And when we were working together, he invited me up to his booth, and he said, come and see what I do. You might be doing this one day. That was in 1968. It was a big joke. We kidded about it. And then in 1985, he did retire. He retired because he wanted to spend more time in the stadium among the crowd and enjoy the games as a spectator rather than as a PA guy. And I asked him who was going to take his place, and he didn't have any idea. I just assumed it was going to be someone from inside. So I wrote a letter to Bob Broadhead, and I didn't know Bob. I didn't know any of his people. He had brought in a bunch of really high-quality people from Miami to help him run the athletic department. Months went by, literally months. And in August of 1986, I got a call from Bob's office, and they had found my letter, and I honestly had forgotten about it. I just not worried about it. One shot into the dark, and let's go on with life. And went over to visit with them, and in about 30 minutes into the interview, they said, you can do this. And I really thanked them, and I asked them why, and the answer was, quote, no one else asked, unquote. And that is an absolute true story. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of power in asking. Even if you get a no, you may get a maybe, and that maybe might turn into a yes. So I always counsel young people to find something that they would love to do, find something that they think that would give them energy, and go ask somebody that does it and see how they got there. And then plan your life that way, you know?
Well, we'll talk to Dan Bornay, the voice of the Valley. Capacity now 102,321 spectators. The ninth largest arena in the world. Tomorrow night, it will be a sellout on paper, but how many people will actually be in the stands? We'll talk more about what's going to happen Saturday night in Tiger Stadium, where it never rains, with Dan Bornay after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Dan Bornay is with us, the voice of the Valley, for now 29 years as of tomorrow night as LSU unveils an expansion project that is state-of-the-art, beautiful, beautiful work done. And LSU has an arena that is no doubt as good or better than any in the world. But unfortunately, instead of playing USC or Alabama or some titan of college football, Florida State or Notre Dame, Sam Houston State comes to town, a team that lost its opener by 21 points to mighty Eastern Washington. Dan, I don't think people are all that enthused about the opponent.
Well, I think they're fired up about the stadium, and you should never shortchange any opponent. We saw over the years, we've had teams that might not have been highly regarded come in and beat us, notably Miami of Ohio and Alabama Birmingham. So these things happen, and underestimate an opponent. But beyond that, I think that the curiosity of the fans is going to be such that we're going to have a lot of people in that stadium because no one has really seen it as it's about to lift off and fly to Shreveport, see, because it's going to be a new experience. It's going to be something totally different. The new South is going to be spectacular. Those video boards are like television sets on 18-wheelers. They're huge. And there's going to be a capability to sequentially engage those boards. So you'll be able to see a play begin on one board, continue on a second board, and end up on the third board. They're going to be all sorts of innovative technological little tricks, and it's going to be spectacular. And I think it's just an example of how you not only have to play football, but you have to entertain people as well, because the attack on time is pretty vicious. People have lots of things they can do in this world now, and they can come and tailgate, and they can go home and watch the game. But we don't want them to do that. We want them to tailgate and come in and watch the game. And so, you know, ramp up the types of things that entertain people when the snap isn't going on. And I think that's great. It's an entertainment venue, and it's a great athletic event. And irrespective of who the team is, hopefully we're going to have 102,300, and what is it, 20?
21, I think.
21.
counting you.
Yeah. Right.
Well,
Me, right.
Yeah, I guess the question is whether LSU will be looking ahead to UL Monroe, have a letdown against Sam Houston State. Now, Dan Bournet, it'll be a smoke-free, tobacco-free campus, according to LSU. This is something, it's kind of a scout's honor thing. It'll be interesting if somebody wants to chew smokeless tobacco or light up a cigarette and then tailgating. That's a no-no now.
Well, somebody above my pay grade is going to have to enforce that. We've had a no-smoking policy in the stadium for a long time, and not only in the stadium itself, but in along the concourses and anywhere in the stadium. So the marshals have done all they can to enforce that. The enforcement of that off the stadium premises itself and on to where the fans are, I don't know how best to enforce it, and I'm not sure who will be. To the extent that they can, I'm sure they will. I'm not sure you're going to get tickets to people who light up. I don't know how they're going to do that. But I think it's admirable that they've tried to apply it campus-wide. Certainly, when we applied it to the stadium, there was no pushback at all. We didn't get any complaints from anybody about prohibiting smoking in Tiger Stadium. So.
There was a great photo in the New York Times earlier this week of Bear Bryant, and it looked like he might have even been in Tiger Stadium in pregame warm-ups with the Crimson Tide. And you remember how he used to lean against the goalpost and intimidate everybody.
Yep.
He was smoking a cigarette in this photo. Bear Bryant. Bear Bryant would not be allowed in Tiger Stadium today.
Well, that might be good. you know, if we had found a way to keep him out when he was coaching, we certainly would have worked on it, I can guarantee. I actually talked to Bear Bryant one time on something totally unrelated to LSU football. I was doing a term paper when I was in graduate school, and one of my friends, one of our colleagues, a woman, actually knew Coach Bryant, and I just offhandedly told her that I'd love to talk to Coach Bryant one day because I was doing a piece on the Bear Bryant-Wally Butts controversy with Look Magazine back when there was this huge story about collusion and fixing games and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it got resolved, and those guys were exonerated, and I think Bear Bryant sued. But it was always quiet as to what had happened, and so... Within a half hour, Jim, and I'm not being facetious, the woman in the office that knew Coach Bryant literally had him on the phone, and I was talking to him. and we didn't get into I couldn't report all of the details, but he gave me the background of it, and he couldn't have been more courteous, and he couldn't have been more gentlemanly, just the kind of guy you would think he would be.
Well, in those days, coaches had listed phone numbers. And I recall when Woody Hayes got in trouble, I called Columbus, Ohio, asked for Wayne Woodrow Hayes, and got his phone number and dialed it. And, hello. You know, today the Imperial coaches forget about it. Les Miles certainly doesn't have a listed phone number. No way. Nick Saban, no listed phone number. No way. They're afraid of the very people who are paying the freight for them to be millionaires.
Well, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think I think a person's cell phone or any kind of telephone, if it's their option to be unlisted, they'll have that option. It's not like these coaches are invincible to questions or invincible to criticism. They make themselves available to the media. They certainly make themselves available to booster groups. They fly around the country speaking to alumni groups. The access that people have to coaches generally is greater than the media has to coaches, because the coaches go to venues where the media doesn't go and have a lot of interaction with folks who pay the freight.
Well, why did Charlie McClendon have a listed number and several coaches since then have not?
Well, the amount of attention, the amount of pressure, the amount of interest in college football is infinitely greater than it is now. And you can only imagine freelance writers who are trying to sell stories to websites or blogs who can barely put a paragraph together, calling a coach at his house saying, "Coach, how many players got hurt today?" Now, I think it's perfectly legitimate and perfectly acceptable not to be accessible those times when you choose not to be.
Well, at last report, the former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, who has $32 billion, he has a listed phone number.
Why don't you call him and see if you can get him?
That would be a good thing. You're right.
How about we put a bet? Well, how about we just wager something that's very simple on this?
Okay.
Let's have lunch at the New Louis. You call Michael Bloomberg and tell him I said hi.
I will do that. That's all I have to do.
Well, you got to talk to him, too.
I might talk to his answering machine.
Well, there you go. Amen. You can always call Coach Miles' office. You can call his office 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Get something.
You're right.
The fact that he doesn't have a listed home number, come on, Jim.
Well, some people today don't even have home numbers.
Well, of course they don't. They don't have any wires in their home at all. They're 100% on the bird, on the satellite, and which is, that subset of that is something you and I are really interested in. And that is, how do you do accurate polling now that you don't really have the demographic mix that you used to have automatically, but with landline.
I knew you'd turn this into a political discussion.
Well, you ought to. But think about it. I've heard pollsters explain it, but I've never really come away comfortable with how they can really certify and verify that they really have the demographic mix that they're looking for in some of the polls.
Okay.
Maybe you have more confidence in it than I do, but it seems to me, man, if people call the house for a poll, that's one thing. I've never gotten a call on a cell phone.
All right. I want to get one caller in with Dan before we get to Steve Allman. Thomas on Lee Drive. Thomas, you're on with Dan.
Good morning, guys. How you doing? And I want to thank Dan for contributing to the etiquette of our younger generation by asking them to please remove their caps when they play the national anthem. Is this something, Dan, that was passed on, or is this something that you originated? Thanks.
Well, I can tell you that story. This is a direct order from Skip Bertman. When Skip was athletic director, Skip got one email from one person who said that the folks in Tiger Stadium, the fellas weren't taking off their hats for the playing of the national anthem. And he asked me to announce it. And I said, "Coach, I don't announce the band. Another fella announces the band." And he, the band is about tradition. The band is about not changing. They haven't changed anything since General Sherman was president. And Skip said, well, do you know how much a tuba costs? So, you know, he explained to me he buys all the tubas for the band. And he explains to me how the athletic department pays for the hotel room when the band goes to bowls and stuff like that. And so, you know, he said, tell the band this has got nothing to do about tradition and lots to do about tubas and hotel rooms, okay? And so I talked to the band about it, and, tradition. And I said, do you know how much a tuba costs? You're kidding me. And, of course, now it's grip. Now, before every athletic event at LSU, the announcer says, please remove your hats. And I have to give you one guess on this.
All right, Dan, I tell you, we were short on time. I do want to get Steve Almond in, but I can barely hear you now, too, so maybe this is an appropriate time to suspend our conversation until a few weeks from now. But good to hear your voice, and we'll hear a lot of it tomorrow night at Tiger Stadium. Thank you, Dan. And we're joined now by Steve Almond, the author of Against Football, One Man's Reluctant Manifesto. And, Steve, you think that all the hype and hoopla and everything that goes with collegiate and professional football is, on the whole, not good. Why not?
Well, a few different reasons. The central one that I talk about in the book is that we're really, and I'm a fan. I have been for 40 years, and I think it's the most exciting game that there is, and I come to these conclusions reluctantly and heartbrokenly, not with anger but with, you know, disappointment. But it's basically consuming a form of entertainment that results in the players, a significant percentage of the players getting very seriously injured and some of them developing brain damage. I don't think that's any great news flash. For me, it took having my mom suffer from an acute dementia to make that real, you know, make that real to me. But I would also say, you know, in terms of the college game, because I know you're in, you know, big college football territory, that it should be strange and unsettling to people that there is an athletic industry that is combined with the educational mission of a place like LSU or any of the other large universities. Those schools are funded by taxpayers. They're tax-exempt. And the reason we do that we pay all that public money, is, in fact, to prepare students to contribute to society, to expand their minds and hopefully get them thinking about what their role is going to be in contributing to America's future. That is very different from the entertainment industry, the billion-dollar entertainment industry that football represents, which is not to say there aren't noble values that are instilled and that football players don't have to be awfully smart to absorb a playbook as thick as Coach Miles' playbook, but that is very different than the basic role of college, which I think we can agree is to educate students and to prepare them academically and intellectually and maybe even morally to contribute to society.
And Steve, you say that NFL owners often hold cities hostage.
Well, I don't say it. The reports say it. So you take a place like Houston, for instance, they lost the Oilers. This is the franchise free agency that you hear about. Because the fans are so devoted to football, because they love it so much, politicians are terrified if any team should possibly move and very eager to keep teams around. And some fans are. I don't think the majority of the public are, but the very loud and vocal minority of fans. So you have, you know, $700 million as a franchise fee that the owner pays in Houston to the NFL, and then you have $250 million in public funds that build a stadium. And the problem is with these stadiums, they're about 70% funded by public funds, but the public never sees a return on that investment. And that's pretty troubling if you think about where a lot of NFL cities, you know, where NFL teams are located. Detroit, St. Louis, Baltimore, these are all places or Minnesota, they allotted $506 million to help a billionaire owner build his stadium, and that state was suffering from a $1.1 billion budget deficit. So there's a financial aspect to this that essentially says, is it worth paying for the public to pay that much money for a form of entertainment as opposed to, say, having more law enforcement officers or better pay for school teachers or things that I think we can all agree are very important, more important ultimately than having a great football team.
The book is Against Football, One Man's Reluctant Manifesto. As you can hear, Steve's a well-spoken man, and hopefully we'll have him on for a longer visit in a searing manifesto, sure to enrage at least half the nation. The best-selling author, Mr. Almond, takes on America's biggest sacred cow, football. Should Should it stay or should it go?
That's really up to the fans. And the bottom line is that the book is attempting to say to fans, look, you built this. And if you're troubled by it, if you have a problem with anything, coach has gotten too big for his britches, he's the highest paid employee at a university, you can't get in touch with him on the phone, you know, it's on the fans ultimately to make that decision. It's not, there's no rescuing angel in a big corporation that's going to cure things until it hits them in the pocketbook. And that's where the fans come in.
Well, Steve, I hope we can have you for a longer visit. You have opened the proverbial can of worms on this one. But it's a good read, Against Football, One Man's Reluctant Manifesto. Until Monday, for Michelle Southern, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.